Welcome one and all to Film Weekly. I'm Zan Brooks, filling in for Jason Solomons, who is still deep in paternity leave. That scent coming out of the headphones is the sweet smell of testosterone, the perfume of the locker room, and that's because this week's show has a decidedly sporting flavour. We'll be discussing boxing with renegade filmmaker James Toback, creator of an extraordinary documentary on Iron Mike Tyson, and talking 70s football with Tom Hooper, director of The Damned United. Plus, I shall be playing metaphorical darts with the film critic Mark Eccleston, on hand to review the week's big releases. So let's get ready to, as they say, rumble. Few men have fallen so spectacularly from grace as Mike Tyson, history's youngest heavyweight champion, and a man who could outpunch anything except his own inner demons. James Toback's documentary shows us a car crash lifestyle of title fights and ear bites, rape convictions and squandered fortunes. It's not a pretty picture, but it is a compelling one, a forensic examination of a tortured psyche.
I walk around the ring, but I never take my eyes off my opponent. I keep my eyes on him, even if he's ready and pumping. He can't wait to get his hands on me as well. I keep my eyes on him. Then once I see a chink in his armor, boom, and one of his eyes may move, and then I know I have him. Then when he comes to the center of the ring, he still looks at me with his piercing look and as if he's not afraid. But he already made that mistake when he looked down for that one-tenth of a second. I know I had him. He'll fight hard for the first two or three rounds, but I know I already broke his spirit. Mike Tyson, greatest fighter ever lived.
And I'm joined on the line by the man who made it. Now, James, I know you've been a friend of Mike Tyson's for many years now. Were you worried that making this film was going to kind of trash that relationship?
No, not at all, because the plan from the beginning was to do it in a quasi-psychoanalytic fashion, just to allow him to present his consciousness as freely and openly and uninhibitedly as possible. And the idea was that knowing that he was capable of articulating the nuances of his mind and life in a very dramatic way, just to let him in his own time come to the things he wanted to say. I mean, there is a confessional need in him, obviously, or he wouldn't have engaged in this from the beginning.
I've read that your aim, you were saying, was to paint Tyson as, quote, a complicated and in many ways noble human being. Now, the noble thing is going to be a stretch for some people here.
Well, flawed nobility and damaged nobility, you'd have to modify the noble because certainly, and the movie makes no attempt to hide it, he has a... He has psychotic aspects to his being, and as he's the first one to admit, many things that he knows he shouldn't have done or knows he should have done and didn't do. So that there's a kind of, I think that's the impulse to confession, and I think that the fact that he is in many ways his own harshest critic makes the inherent decency of the guy believable in a way that it wouldn't be if the movie seemed to be an apology in any sense, which I don't believe that it is.
But let's talk about one of the perhaps the key thing that he did or didn't do. I mean, in the film, Tyson freely admits to what sounded to me like a kind of borderline abusive relationship with women, and yet he still denies raping Desiree Washington. And again, some people are going to find those two statements very hard to kind of square and marry. What's your own kind of take on that?
In any rendition of events, whatever they are, between two people, particularly in a sexual situation, but really any situation, the only truth is going to be approximate. Or Bob Evans used to say, there are three versions of every story, your version, my version, and the truth. I can only say in this case that over the years, Mike has bitterly denied to me, and I haven't asked him, I don't bring it up, and I don't grill him, and I don't prosecute him, but whenever it's come up vaguely, he has so vehemently dismissed her charges as a lot more than untrue. I would doubt, knowing him as I do, that there would be any reason on earth for him to, for him over the years to continue to be that vehement in denial, what would be the point? What am I going to do?
Yeah, he served the time.
Yeah, it just makes no sense whatsoever. But I think because he has this sort of stream of consciousness that he doesn't censor, his mind in the movie flows from that to saying, I'm not saying I didn't behave like a jerk with other women. It's just that in no way did I take this woman's chastity, which is a rather quaint Victorian way of putting it.
Let's talk about the reaction to the film, which I saw at the Cannes Film Festival last year, where Ewan Tyson introduced it. And he seemed kind of stunned by the reaction. I mean, he got a huge standing ovation. So it implied that he wasn't kind of expecting that kind of response at all.
Far from it. In fact, I later found out that he and his managers were standing outside the theater, having been at dinner with their families, as the movie was ending. And he said to the managers, do you think Jim would mind if I just went back to the hotel? And they said, no, you've got to go in the theater. And he said, but what if they hate it? And after he saw it at Sundance, he said something at the dinner afterward that was quite interesting. He said, you know, I always wondered why people would say they were scared of me or they thought I was crazy. Or he said, other than in the ring, I just felt, well, what are you talking about? Why are you scared? What is there to be scared of? And he said, watching this movie tonight, meaning at Sundance, it's the first time I actually thought to myself, now I know why people were scared of me. I'm scared of that guy.
Yeah. That was Tyson director James Toback talking to me there, and Tyson is unleashed this week. Stepping into the ring with me now is film critic Mark Eccleston. Mark, you won't be going to see Tyson, or does it appeal?
Tyson's a very odd person, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's surprisingly, this film paints him in all of his oddness.
That's right. And one of the things I get across here is that he's also quite intelligent, which I didn't see coming.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, I think he is. But almost you wonder kind of to what purpose that he has that kind of weird understanding of what makes him do the things he does, and yet still keeps on doing them.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's move on to some of the other week's big releases. Two Lovers is the new film from James Gray, once tipped as the bright young hope of American indie cinema. It's a pungent love triangle drama in which Joaquin Phoenix plays a troubled soul who's just had a breakdown, so no stretch there then. Holed up in his family's Brooklyn home, Phoenix finds himself paired off with Vanessa Shaw, who plays the daughter of a family friend. Trouble is, he's more drawn to the flighty, exciting Gwyneth Paltrow. He's torn between two lovers and acting like a fool.
Hey, what are you doing? You taking my picture?
Yeah. Well, I was actually trying to get your attention.
Oh, you got it.
How you doing?
Good, what's going on?
You look all dressed up.
Oh, well, I'm going out. I'm going to go dancing with some friends of mine. What about you? What are you doing?
I was thinking about maybe going out, but, you know, I don't know.
Leonard, we can't have that.
Hey,
come with us.
You ever heard of a goddamn phone?
Why don't you come with us?
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
It's going to be good.
All right.
We're going to leave in like 30 minutes. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Mark, obvious first question, Vanessa Shaw or Gwyneth Paltrow, which of these two lovers would you have gone for?
Yes, this is the eternal dilemma, isn't it, really? And setting up very clear points in this love triangle between someone who's intoxicating but shallow and needy, that's Gwyneth Paltrow's character, or someone who offers the kind of comfort and companionship of a long-term relationship, which is the family friend played by Vanessa Shaw. And on top of, I think, what is a standard love triangle, you have the manic depressive Leonard, played by Joaquin Phoenix, which swings either way for him, which one he wants. I was very interested by this film, actually, and I wonder if I was interested in more of it because there's an idea that this is going to be Wacky's last kind of film, basically.
Yeah.
He's moved on to music. And I wonder if, you know, taking that out of the equation, it's quite as interesting as people are saying. I mean, I think Joaquin Phoenix is an incredibly interesting, intense actor and someone who clearly doesn't feel there's any moral obligation to make people feel comfortable with his characters here. And Leonard is, in some ways, a bit of a loser. I mean, I don't know if you remember that scene when they go to the club, but on the way in the car, he does this sort of rap to Gwyneth Paltrow's character.
Yeah.
And it's not quite good enough.
Yeah.
And then he does a little sort of body-popping dance and something rather... She didn't want to sort of almost look at the screen there, but there's something compelling about him that still makes you want to see his journey, basically.
It's an odd film. At times, I mean, you could imagine, if you have like a Hollywood film about the love wrangles of a manic depressive bipolar individual, you can kind of almost imagine it being played by Adam Sandler or something.
Yes.
Whereas this was very somber, very sober, very kind of serious, and struck me as the sort of film that Hollywood or American cinema doesn't really make these days.
I agree, and I think James Gray is one of the few directors that's interested in this kind of stuff and has found, you know, previously with We Own the Night and The Yards in Joaquin Phoenix, his sort of rather troubled muse here. But it sets out its stall pretty early on that this is going to be fairly intense, grim drama when you see Joaquin Phoenix trying to drown himself, because this is set in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn area, basically, where all James Gray's films are. Mm. And he has a dead-end job. He works as a sort of delivery boy for his father's dry-cleaning business. And that's it. I mean, there isn't an awful lot to kind of say about this apart from if you're interested in kind of thoughtful and very strongly acted kind of lead movies, which look at the sort of messiness of relationships, then this is, I think it's very strong, actually. I think it's going to be overlooked, but I think there's something good going on here.
I like this a lot, too. I thought that this was a kind of mature, serious, stately film, very well acted. I thought that there was a slight problem, going back to our initial dilemma, that I thought that James Gray was too infatuated with Gwyneth Paltrow, and maybe he should have been a bit more, given a bit more time to Vanessa Shaw, who seemed a more interesting story that was going on there. But I guess if you have Gwyneth Paltrow in a film, it becomes more about Gwyneth.
Yes. No, I think it also represents, as you suggested earlier, your own infatuations for Gwyneth Paltrow,
well, yeah,
or Vanessa Shaw, that you think, oh, the director didn't spend enough time with the one I liked, you know. But it technically he did, you know. I mean, you're seeing the number of dates. If you probably weigh them up, there is probably the same amount of screen time here, basically.
Yeah, maybe it's just Paltrow has that star wattage that kind of bleaches everything out.
Yeah, it's a dimming star wattage, I must say. She's kind of suffering this curse of the Best Actress Oscar, basically. And that's gone down for Halle Berry and Julia Roberts and Charlize Theron and Reese Witherspoon, which is, after Shakespeare in Love, not really finding anything which is really worthy of her talents, basically. And sort of drifting.
Poor millionaire Gwyneth.
But we should also maybe feel sorry for Joaquin Phoenix, because, you know, he has set out on this music career, and I don't know if you've seen this, but you should see the gig he does in Vegas, because he comes on stage, he does three songs, and they sound like this, like... I mean, it's not well recorded, obviously.
See, that sounded all right.
Yeah, thank you. And then he falls off stage. It's like someone's pulled a trapdoor. Oh, he just slides downstage. He's got a huge beard, this big woolly kind of moth-eaten hat, dark sunglasses. But interestingly, he's being filmed here by Casey Affleck, who's his brother-in-law, having married Summer Phoenix. And rumours are emerging that what's going on here is some sort of spoof art project, and the joke will be on us.
Yeah.
And he'll turn around and say, you know, as Ashton Kutcher hilariously does, you've been pranked, basically. So that's that.
As actors, you just can't trust them.
No, you can't.
Let's move on to Geneva.
Yes.
Which is the upteenth film from the very prolific British director Michael Winterbottom. Now, this is a supernatural teen romance stroke ghost story. It features Colin Firth as Joe, a widower struggling to get over the death of wife Hope Davis in a car crash.
Make sure she can't see.
Okay, here's one.
Black.
Do that.
I think your hands are see-through, honey. Oh,
they are.
She's looking, isn't she?
Mary! No, no!
We are here today to share our grief together and to pay tribute to Marianne's life.
Going away isn't a cure.
Well, I think a year in Italy at their age would be fantastic, wouldn't you?
There, Mary is plagued by nightmares and visions while Kelly cops off with a local Italian youth. I guess this is sort of two sides of the grieving process here. Mark, are you a fan of Winterbottom's work?
Yeah, I mean, I must say, when he's good, he's great, and when he's bad, he's awful. I mean, Welcome to Sarajevo, A Mighty Heart, and 24-Hour Party People, I think, is the great nine songs. Just kind of switched me off as an idea that this was someone who was consistent. And this, I don't think, is his best work. Really. I mean, part of it is because I'm generally not in the mood to see people's healing process from grief on screen.
Mm.
Yeah, call me harsh, but I've seen 21 Grams, Reservation Road, The Sun's Room, In the Bedroom. And here we have a similar situation. And in casting, Colin Firth is typically the stoic Brit who can never really express his emotions anyway. It's just going to be hard work, you know, from the word go. And I simply wasn't in the kind of mood to go with that, basically. Although the performance is strong and it's intimate because it's Michael Winterbottom and he has that kind of, you know, nice handheld docudrama feel that lets you into sort of families here. I mean, you say
the performances are good. Who did you think was good in it?
Well, I think here we have Colin Firth, you know, and people rarely give him leads these days. And I think he kind of opened up a little more than I've seen him before. And one of the daughters here, Willa Holland, is spectacularly beautiful. She's from the OC, but she has this kind of sort of model sensibility, which is sort of like catnip to these Italian boys who just sort of chase around on scooters going, bella, bella. I found her performance interesting as well, and the other kids' performance interesting. But really, it was just like going on holiday with Colin Firth and coming back and thinking, it wasn't that great, was it? You know,
He'd never invite us.
Yeah, the kids were always arguing, and then one of them ran off, and you know, he was a bit moody, wasn't he? I wasn't convinced as well about, and I don't know whether you could explain this to me, but what Colin Firth did as a job. He's a lecturer. He gets a job at university. What is he lecturing on? Did you get much of that?
I always find that Hollywood movies gloss over those kind of things. And weirdly, the next movie has Uma Thurman as a lecturer. And there's a couple of kind of throwaway scenes where she's lecturing kind of students. But it doesn't really kind of go into any of the details.
No, it doesn't. Because he had this whole group of students and he'd say, so, you know, how do you feel about the euro? I mean... Do you get a flat and enough money to support a family for that kind of stuff? You know, but he's a sort of, you know, literary professor. I honestly couldn't work out what this job was. And also I think calling it Genova and setting it in Genova, the alternative title for that city, suggests that you're going to find that city as a character and you'll find more about it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really find much going on there. I mean, they went to the beach, they went to a restaurant, and there was a few kind of back alleys where bit of an ominous score turned up and there was a dead rat and Michael Winterbottom hovered his camera over the dead rat and maybe something bad would happen and it didn't. But I never felt sort of I knew much about the city. You see what I mean? Or there was much kind of love for that city. It was just a sort of...
Do you think he just makes too many films?
This one was one too many. No, I don't know. I think he's very interested in people. I think he thinks in somehow in this process, and it's a similar process, but not quite as odd as Mike Leigh's, that something will emerge out of all this. But I didn't feel this time it really clicked, basically. You know, Catherine Keener's character, I don't know where that was going. She was kind of his friend from Harvard, but I was a bit obsessed about him. But just sort of acted as a sort of tour guide, you know, and sort of... Oh, what's that flag? Well, actually, that's the flag of St. George, isn't that? Not England's flag. No, the Genoese discovery. Oh, she's like a tour guide. Yeah. And the idea as well of Hope Davis, the sort of dead mother, just at times appearing in the corner of a scene because the daughter sees her.
It's a bit Don't Look Now at times, wasn't it?
It was Don't Look Now in reverse, in that the kids, you know, the kid sees the dead person rather than the parents see the dead kid. But yeah, no, very, very good. But nowhere near as good as that terms of that kind of creepy crackle. It was just a bit odd, you know. And also the father here couldn't understand why his kid was waking up and screaming at the night, although she kept saying, Mummy. And then he found loads of pictures of which were sort of drawings of mummy in the background.
These films always do drawings, don't they? They always do creepy drawings, which kind of shows how their psyche is falling apart.
That's right. And they're always found by the parents who go, oh, look, a little ghost of mother. He's thinking about my... You know, I mean, it's called psychology. Surely you can work this out. It just didn't work for me, you know.
No, it didn't work for me either, okay. Mark, I have to say. Let's move on to the third film that hopefully worked for both of us. This is The Life Before Her Eyes, stars Uma Thurman as the adult survivor of a Columbine-style high school massacre. Now, this is 15 years later and she's haunted. She's kind of bedeviled by flashbacks to that terrible day, remembering the time when she was a footloose teenager played by Evan Rachel Wood. The life passes not in a flash, but in a kind of slow, soft-focus blur.
Come on, girls. It's time to choose.
This week, on the 15th anniversary of the tragic date, a memorial at Hillview High School, honoring both the victims and the survivors.
Tonight, I'm going to try and get some sleep.
When is it all going to start?
When is what going to start?
Our lives, not all of this.
Mark Eccleston, I know it's the cardinal sin for a reviewer to refer to a film as boring, so let's just say I found this one a little, I don't know, tiresome.
Yes, in a boring kind of way. I mean, this is strange because the director here is Vadim Perelman, and he did House of Sand and Fog.
Which I quite liked.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a big quality drama, Jennifer Connelly and Ben Kingsley, obviously. And here I think there's a cheat going on in that it sets it out to be a different kind of film, as a moral obligation to be that kind of film, because it is centred, as you say, on the Columbine massacre at a small school. And with that comes so much kind of emotionally laden thoughts and emotional connection to some of the scenes you're seeing with the police arriving and parents being pushed back into the street and the sound of gunfire in classrooms. But it doesn't want to actually have the bravery to deal with the psychology of, you know, in the same way sort of Gus Van Sant's Elephant did very well. It wants to stay clear of that idea and use it as a construct for what we find out in the end is a film that's a cheap and twisty thriller. Okay, now I know people just say you're already giving the film away by suggesting there's a twist somewhere towards the end, but I've got to say at the end I felt this has left me feeling morally queasy about just using that as background to something that's a bit clever like a jigsaw. Oh, well done to us. Very beautifully shot, but still, I can't be having with this one now.
There was also, I agree entirely with all of that, and I did feel manipulated. And you know, I didn't see the twist coming until maybe about kind of 10 minutes before it came. But even so, I thought that it was kind of redundant, really. It was cheap. The other problem that I had with it is a much more prosaic problem, in that I didn't believe Evan Rachel Wood was the young Uma Thurman.
Right.
They're both kind of very identifiable actors who really do not look much alike each other. And maybe there's a way... I think it's complicated as well because you're supposed to believe that Uma Thurman is a reformed character. She's nothing like the Evan Rachel Wood character. But it still stuck with me and I couldn't quite make that imaginative leap.
Yes. I mean, I think I know what you're saying, that Evan Rachel Wood is quite delicate and feminine. And Uma Thurman is beautiful, but in a more sort of handsome, strange way. And that's a strange way. And you're right, I never saw their two stories as being joined because they were the same person. I was a little uncomfortable. I don't know, that's just being odd. But how much time the director spent, you know, lingering on these shots of Rachel Wood getting in and out of the pool in a bikini.
Lots of slow-mo there, wasn't there?
A lot of slow-mo. A lot of kind of flicking her hair, getting the water out, all diving in and out and in and out. I thought, oh dear. And how much time he spent, instead of actually dealing with the story and dealing with character, on just clouds, or maybe an ant climbing on a dead flower.
And some, also live flowers. There are a lot of flowers kind of blooming.
Yes, but then there were some dead ones later.
Dead ones later, symbolising the death of innocence, was that?
Death of flowers.
I don't know.
It was just like, stop doing that.
Yeah.
It's another cloud shot. I'll go mad. You know, it really wasn't.
This was a spectacularly portentous film, wasn't it?
Yes, and
you're kind of,
yes, it was.
You're basically having your arm twisted, saying, you know, dead flowers means that you must feel something now.
Yeah, that's right.
And without actually doing any of the heavy lifting itself.
But also the dialogue didn't kind of click as well for me. There was this moment where Uma Thurman says, I don't know about you, but I could do with some soup. Right? And then someone is given a lecture as a biology teacher and says the heart is the body's strongest muscle.
Which is repeated again and again, isn't it?
Which I've seen in a number of films, really. This has been knocking around for a while. I mean, I think it came out almost a year ago in the States. It wasn't pushed to us as reviewers. They weren't offering that many screenings. And I think borderline they were going to pull this one. I just have that feeling that this is a time of year, post-Oscar quality and pre-money spring-summer, that some of the studios are looking to maybe dump a bit of stuff out there and hopefully get some money back. And I think this is one of these films that you wouldn't see at any other time of year.
So The Life Before Her Eyes is dumped in cinemas this week. Mark Eccleston, thank you so much for joining me.
It's nice
been
to
an
meet
absolute
you.
Joy to have you here for the very first time in the pod studio, and hopefully it will not be the last. Please, please do come back again. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks a lot.
Based on the best-selling book by Red Riding author David Peace, The Damned United reimagines Brian Clough's disastrous 44 days managing Leeds United back in 1974. At the time, Clough was a cocksure hotshot, fresh from conjuring lowly Derby County to glory. But hubris was to be his undoing when faced with the uglier, more physical side of football in Leeds. The Damned United stars that chameleon presence Michael Sheen as Clough, Timothy Spall as his shunned colleague Peter Taylor, and Colm Meaney as former Leeds boss Don Revie.
Missing the target from there, you want plumbing shooting! Now get in there! That's what I pay you for!
170 grand for Colin Blooming Todd.
Correction, the almighty Colin Todd, the best technical footballer in the country.
And a salary of £300 a week. You can't pay a footballer that.
That's the way things are going, Uncle Sam. Football's all about money now.
I told you, never to go over my head again.
The film is scripted by Peter Morgan and marks the feature debut of director Tom Hooper, who made his name on the TV dramas Daniel Deronda and Longford. And Tom Hooper joins me on the line now. Tom, I'm assuming you must have been a massive football fan before starting work on this movie.
Well, the surprising thing is that I wasn't. I think I was a massive fan of the script, and when Peter Morgan, who I'd worked with on Longford, sent me the script, I was in Hungary shooting the final weeks of John Adams, and I'd spent the day with Paul Giamatti playing the second president of the United States, and dealing with this character who was egocentric yet flawed, ambitious yet self-destructive, and came home and read a screenplay about Brian Clough, and let's just say I saw the similarities.
Yeah.
And sitting in that Hungarian hotel bedroom, that, you know, the script completely hooked me. And given I played football at school, and I take an interest in the fortunes of the English game, but I'm not a big club supporter. I was amazed at how it managed to capture my imagination and move me and make me laugh without me knowing the details of the 1968-74 period. In fact, I was born in 1972, so it's a little bit before I have memory of, but I can assure you I now have kind of memory implants of most of the key things that the story deals with. I feel I was there watching Giles punch Kevin Keegan in 1974 at the Charity Shield.
What's your own view of Brian Clough, having made this film? I mean, he's a man who even now seems to kind of divide opinions.
You know, I suppose firstly he was he was maybe the original manager who shared the dramas of management with an audience. Mm. And that now we're very used. If we open the sports pages, we read on a daily basis the trials and tribulations of Ferguson, Scolari, Benitez, whereas I think Clough was the first celebrity manager who brought us into the narrative of management. I mean, he was ubiquitous as a celebrity, but I think it must be something more than that, and more than his success as a manager. I think it was his wit and the fact that people used to look forward to watching on TV because he was controversial. You never knew what he was going to say, and he was kind of irreverent and he never seemed to be scared of kind of towing any sort of line. And I think we loved him for his irreverence, and I think as a subject for drama, he's so fascinating because he combines this incredible ambition and desire to succeed with this ability to take apart success once he's achieved it. And I think both Peter Morgan and I were fascinated to explore the psychology of this man. And also, I think our story is a story about hubris, and we're living in times when hubristic narratives have a particular power because of the financial crisis. We live in times where very powerful people have been brought low, or as a nation we want them to be brought low, and frustrated that they haven't been. And our story is about a very successful man learning that his success is dependent on someone else, Peter Taylor, his assistant, and having to be brought down to earth in learning that.
That is an area of the film where it slightly differs from the book, because I know that it slightly changes the tone and the focus of Peace's novel, which was, I think, strongly criticised by the Clough family for painting him as a sort of raging, paranoid alcoholic. Why did you sort of take a slightly different direction with the film?
I think the more I researched it, the more I felt there was a risk that the Clough of his last years, Clough after the tragic death of his assistant and professional partner Peter Taylor, Clough when he was clearly being ravaged by his alcoholism very, very visibly, there's a risk that Clough could overshadow the young Clough of our movie, who actually had his greatest successes, his double European Cup win at Nottingham Forest ahead of him. You know, Clough when he was in the kind of full, you know, at his full power and was kind of a star in this country, and I wanted to make sure that we lived in the present tense of Clough without letting what we know about what happened to him, you know, sort of discolour or distort the story we were telling.
Thanks to Tom Hooper, director of The Damned United. And that's it. That's the bell for the end of this round. Thanks also to James Toback and to Mark Eccleston and to my producer, Sarah Peters. Jason Solomons makes his grand comeback next week. But for the meantime, this is Zan Brooks on Film Weekly, toweling down and preparing to hang up my belt. Thanks for listening.